Computer, initialize holosuite.
Good evening, and welcome to yet another broadcast of The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. I am one of your hosts, Perry, and I'm joined with David.
Hey, guys. Tonight we're talking about Season 1, Episode 10, The Negus. Before we continue, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts as The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast.
That is correct, and you should also be able to find us this week because we got a special shout out from Miss Tawny Newsom, the one and only Beckett Mariner from Star Trek: The Lower Decks, which you can see every Thursday night on CBS Plus. It's now Paramount Plus. So, yeah, great. Check that show out and check our show out whenever you get the chance. Yeah, a lot of good things are happening in Star Trek world. So before we actually dive into our episode, I did want to talk about some of that. So what some people may have noticed by now is that a lot of Trek is now gone from Netflix. We lost Voyager, the original series, and Enterprise. They're all gone from Netflix now. So if that was a place that you were watching, a lot of those shows, you can't anymore. They've all been moved to Paramount Plus, which seems to be now consolidating its Trek base. So now, in addition to all the other Star Trek shows that you can find on there, which were Picard, Lower Decks, Prodigy's going to be on there soon, so is Strange New Worlds. Deep Space Nine is there as well, as is Next Generation. Now you can have Enterprise, Voyager, and the original series. They're basically just pulling it all together and getting it off of other platforms. It was bound to happen, especially now that they have rebranded from CBS One to Paramount Plus. But I know that it came as a shock to some people who were watching it right up until October 1st, and suddenly it was gone. So, but as it stands right now, again, if you're still using Netflix, you can still watch The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine on Netflix. But I believe, even though they haven't announced it yet, I believe that is short-lived. I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of this year, both of those shows are off there, and the only place that you could find it would be Paramount Plus. And I also think Hulu still has them, but I think that again, all those are again going to be going away, going to Paramount Plus as they continue this sci-fi Trek consolidation move that they're doing right now. So you might as well just sign up for Paramount Plus. It's cheap, it's simple, and there's a lot of other great shows on there too to watch. So just get Paramount Plus and watch Trek there.
Alrighty.
So, like we said, we're talking about the episode The Negus. Do you want to give a summation, or do you want me to do it?
Sure, I can do it. In this episode, we have Quark as our primary character. He is visited by the Grand Negus. Perry, correct me here. Is the Grand Negus Zek, or is that his son? Because there's a little bit of confusion there about the name of who's who.
Zek is the Grand Negus.
Is the Grand Negus. Okay, yes. All right. So the Grand Negus... Again, Perry, you're going to have to maybe work out a few details after I get this summation. But for the moment, he is some form of higher official within the Ferengi Alliance. And he comes to Deep Space Nine, and Quark is initially a little upset about this because he thinks that the Grand Negus has come to take over Quark's, his bar, because it's so close to the wormhole, and therefore... he's going to have to give over the bar to the Grand Negus without being able to really protest. And so thinks that that's going to, you know, backfire on him to have the Negus here. But the Grand Negus decides, after having a meeting with a number of other Ferengi, that he's going to pass on his title to someone new. And he chooses Quark, which is great for Quark. He's suddenly this high official. the one he was just a moment ago afraid of. He is now the one holding the scepter, the one that everyone must kiss. And so he goes around all happy about his new position. But his brother and the son of the Grand Nagus decide that they don't want Quark to be the new Nagus. They want the power for themselves, or in the case of Quark's brother, he wants the bar for himself. And so they attempt to throw Quark out an airlock, which the Grand Nagus suddenly arrives and reveals that he's we thought he was dead for a time. He looks like he's passed on, and so Quark is not only the Grand Nagus, but the original Grand Nagus has also died. But it turns out he's still alive. He shows up, stops the attempt to kill Quark, and reveals that the whole thing was actually a giant attempt to actually get his son to properly assume the mantle of the Grand Nagus. Initially, what he says to his son is that, "I wanted you to take over Quark's, the bar, so that while Quark would have all the official authority, you would actually have all the true knowledge about what's going on with the wormhole, and then you would work from behind the scenes and eventually gain the official title of Grand Nagus after working your own machinations." So he takes back his authority and power. Quark goes back to being just a bar keep, and instead of punishing his brother for his attempt on his life, he says, "You deserve to be rewarded for your nefarious deeds, right. your attempt on my life. You actually deserve something." And tells his brother he'll reward him. The side plot of this episode is that Jake is still trying to be friends with Nog, the Ferengi boy, and they have kind of a falling out because Ferengi apparently don't typically go to school and get schooling, and while Nog has been kind of a bad influence on Jake, and Sisko is worried about that, it turns out that Jake is actually a good friend to Nog and actually helps him learn to read when his father actually is expecting to spend time with him. So there's a scene where Sisko goes looking for Jake and finds both Jake and Nog in a private area of the station, and Jake is actually teaching Nog how to properly read. And so the friendship that we were a little worried about and that we were concerned was negatively affecting Jake is actually a place where Jake is learning to be a responsible and compassionate young man. And we also get a casual reference to some fire caverns at the beginning of this episode. I myself do not know why we have titled our show The Fire Caves, but I feel like we're moving steadily in that direction. So, Perry, did I forget anything?
No, not really. That's a pretty good summation. Obviously, we don't go point for point on the plot here, and there's no need. Because, again, the show is, like, as I say every week, it's like 30 years old. So if you haven't watched it yet, go watch it. I think it's like become my new favorite thing to say. Yes, please go watch the show. It is available on all those lovely platforms that I just told you about earlier. And you can watch it. You can pause this. You can go watch it. Come back, and you will be all the more enriched by what we talk about, because now you will have a frame of reference. So please go watch Star Trek Deep Space Nine, then come back and join us. We would appreciate it. But yes, so now this allows us to do a little bit of a deep dive on the species that I kind of love to hate, which are the Ferengi. They have been a part of Star Trek ever since they were first introduced in The Next Generation. I believe the first episode that we see them, really see them anyway, is Where Silence Has Lease. And that's where they stumble upon an old... The Enterprise crew stumbles upon like an old outpost. No, that's what it was called. The Last Outpost, not Where Silence Has Lease. It's The Last Outpost, because they stumble upon the last outpost of the Iconia people, I believe that was. And no, I'm getting this all wrong. I'm mixing them all up, and it's like flashing in my head when I get it wrong. It was the T'Kan Empire. They found the last outpost of the T'Kan Empire. They beam down. The Ferengi are there. The Ferengi use their weird little whips to knock people out and, you know, all that good stuff. But that was, again, the first time that we see them. And they're very kind of, you know, menacing, gross, but childlike, you know, caricatures was a great way to think about them, like human parodies. And right. So now we see there's been, in a sense, an evolution of the Ferengi people, which basically just means somebody really went to town on working out their backstory. So Zek is the Grand Nagus of the Ferengi Alliance. The Grand Nagus is basically our equivalent of president or prime minister. Okay, this is the top dog in their society. And since their society is heavily capitalistic and commerce based, this individual influences all of their major money making, all the deals, all the investments, everything. This person is it for them, right? And right. And you attain the title of Grand Nagus by being the most ruthless, the most cunning, and obviously amassing the largest fortune. And the longer that you can hold on to that fortune, the more you're seen as a wise and valuable person, and your stature elevates until eventually either you become Grand Nagus or someone kills you and takes over your right. business.
Okay? Yeah.
And so that's what we were seeing here in this episode. Zek is, he's realized there's a great opportunity that exists on the other side of the wormhole, and he's also set it up as, hey, I've been doing this for far too long. It's not going to be me that can lead this next big business venture. We're going to need somebody else. And that's when he kind of sets up Quark to do this, and it, as David just said, it's all revealed to be a very, very much an elaborate plot in which Zek was testing his son, whose name was Crax.
Right.
He was testing his son to see if he could basically show he had the lobes for business, which is the Ferengi reference, obviously, to their ears. A lot of significance placed on Ferengi ears. If you have the large ears of a promising Ferengi entrepreneur, then obviously you're seen as to have more business acumen, whereas if you have the small lobes of typically a female Ferengi, which we haven't seen at this point, but if you have the small lobes and you're like a female, and females have no place in business, at least according to Ferengi society. Okay, so this is kind of our first intro into that, and we also see the Ferengi remark on the fact that in the Alpha Quadrant, they're kind of renowned for being dirty, scandalous, underhanded business dealers,
yep.
And that after you do maybe a little bit of business with them, you don't want to go in deep with a Ferengi because they are basically backstabbers. They only honor the word of another Ferengi, and even then, it's tenuous at best if they're going to hold to it, but they right. don't really consider deals with other people as binding as they do between Ferengi. So, you know, they've kind of put up with that for a while, and now they're looking to expand into the Gamma Quadrant and bring that whole nasty way of doing business with them.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot going on here with the Ferengi. It was really cool to see. I did enjoy the cultural dynamic development, like when Zek finds out that Rom had been sending his kid to a school that was being taught by a human female. He was just like, the confusion and then just the frustration and all. He was like, you sent him to school?
Yeah.
You know, and then it was like, he has what? Homework? Like, the right. whole thing was just great. You know, and then, of course, you know, you have Nog, who is, he's clearly interested in going to school and he wants to learn, but he's trapped by his own culture. And, you know, he's...
Right.
He's the product of someone who's grown up far away from his homeworld. Like, I'm sure that if he had been on the Ferengi homeworld, this never would have been an issue, right? But
right.
because he now lives on a station which is surrounded by various cultures, he's influenced by them. He's influenced by the various people that come through the station, you know?
Right.
And so to suddenly be told that he can't do this thing that everyone else that he's encountered, all the kids his age, young and younger and older, they're all going to school and everything else, and he's being told he can't do it. Of course, this sets him up as, you know, the outsider in this situation. So yeah, very stressful time for the young guy as he's trying to figure out what he wants to do with
right.
his own life, you know. So yeah, I love this episode. It gives us a lot of insights into both Ferengi culture, and of course we get to see one of my favorite relationships which is Ben and Jake, the father-son, you know, relationship. So,
right.
But before we get into that, we'll talk about all that stuff later. I don't want to sit here and just be like me, just going on and on and on forever. What were some things that you liked about this episode, David?
Oh, I thought this was a great episode. The one thing that really stood out to me that I just loved, and I had to stop the episode and make sure I was right, was when I realized that Wallace Shawn was playing the Grand Nagus.
Yes, yes.
His voice is so iconic. He's most well known for playing Vicini from The Princess Bride. But he also played like T-Rex in the Toy Story series. Mm-hmm. And I know there's another reference I could think of, but that's those ones that stick off my head right now. But as soon as I heard his voice, I was like, wait a minute, who is that? And I had to look it up right away. And I knew his voice, but I couldn't remember his name. And it was funny because it's about 10 minutes in before he actually says anything. He he has his son doing all his, you know, my father wants to do this. The Grand Nagus wants to do that. And so he doesn't really say much for about 10 minutes into the episode. But then during the dinner scene, he invites himself to dinner with Quark, and Quark is obviously unhappy about it, which is funny because he doesn't hide it at all. He doesn't do a very good job, but it doesn't seem like he's supposed to of expressing his displeasure. He's like, on one hand, he's, you know, trying to, you know, be a, you know, suck up, but then like he turns around and says, in not that, you know, much softer of a voice, he says, you know, oh great, that's going to be where he tells me he wants the bar. So it was a fun scene to, you know, see that interaction between the characters, but then to hear Wallace Shawn's voice come out behind all that makeup and be like, oh my gosh, this is perfect. They clearly cast, you know, people who are shorter to be Ferengi. Mm-hmm. And Wallace Shawn is a shorter guy, but he fits perfectly in to this culture. And he took the scene as soon as he showed up, as soon as I realized it was him. And he definitely has a commanding presence throughout any scene he's in. So it was great. He was a standout. But this is another episode where I just am like, yeah, I think Armin Shimerman as Quark is the standout character and actor on the show so far. I mean, I've loved Kira so far. I've mentioned that multiple times. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like other cast members have potential, but I feel like Quark is the one who's really actually been given the most time on screen, or at least Armin Shimerman is really, he just plays the character to perfection, which makes sense because I guess, you know, he had a chance to play several Ferengi before on The Next Generation, as you were just describing. I think he was in at least several of those episodes already.
Well, he was in The Last Outpost. He's the main Ferengi that we see talk the most in that episode,
right?
You know,
exactly.
He's definitely has had a lot of time to really kind of understand the nature and dynamic of Ferengi, you know, life. And I mean, he's credited also with kind of the restructuring that Ferengi go through, you know, instead of just being, because they're just really one dimensional on Next Gen. They were always very scheming, scandalous, nefarious creatures, right? That we still look down upon. Whereas now in Deep Space Nine, he's elevated them to a different level of complexity that eventually, grudgingly, you have to appreciate, you know?
Right. So, well, it's interesting. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, as a person who started off absolutely loathing Ferengi, Quark is the only one that I'm like, okay, except for you. Like, the rest of you.
What's interesting about Shimmerman's portrayal of Quark is that when you initially see the Ferengi on Next Generation, a lot of times whenever they meet someone, they're very sycophantic. You know, they're bending over and they're looking up and they try and bribe people, but they're so obvious about it. Quark actually has some... Yeah, he actually seems to have a little bit of self-awareness. He is as just as guilty of acting like that as those other characters. He can be just as sycophantic, but he has some sort of pride about him that makes him stand out. He's he's a little more arrogant. He's not he is a different character, and it makes it feels like Armin Shimmerman has really made the race his own. The Ferengi, he is the Ferengi. It sounds like he's been there from the beginning. So whatever it is that they are, he had so much input that you can effectively say that he's the one who created the Ferengi. And that's fantastic that we have him here to continue to let us see more into their culture.
Right. Yeah. In a lot of ways, he's like what you know, Leonard Nimoy was to the Vulcan race. Like, even yeah. though Spock was half human, you know, he is largely credited with the formation of the Vulcan race. Like, he was just called the Vulcan, and Gene Roddenberry right. certainly had a lot of input back in those days. I mean, it was the '60s and everything else, you know, he had a lot of input, but then, you know, over the course of the intervening decades, what we came to know and understand about Vulcans came largely from the character of Spock. And so that right. portrayal became such a, it was such a huge thing, because at any time that you ever wanted to portray another Vulcan somewhere else, there had to be, mm-hmm. always had to be a basis which started with Leonard Nimoy and Spock. You just, you right. have to. And right. I think that's even true now, even though we've seen several different Vulcans by now, you know, from Spock to Tuvok and Sarek and T'Pol and so forth. There have been so many, but still, they all have to, you have to go back to that original right. one. And I think that's how it's always going to be whenever they portray or reference Ferengi in the future, is that, I mean, if you're going to do anything where they're prominently featured, you have to start with Quark, because if you don't, you're going to mess up. You're going to get some things wrong, you know. So
right.
But yeah, so, and yeah, Armin Shimron is definitely should be and is credited with that. He did a great job.
Yeah.
There, you know.
Yep.
One Ferengi that I just don't like, and I've tried, is Rom. Rom is an idiot. You know, it just, like, it's said over and over again, Rom is an idiot, my idiot brother, you know. And he just right. he just bothers me, because it's like what you said, he maintains that very simpering, sycophantic mindset throughout everything. Like, he is so quick
right.
to try to appease the most powerful person in the room. Like, obviously that's normally always his brother, and right. then, you know, all of a sudden we see Zek is here, and when Zek finds out that his son has homework, he just, I never want you going back to that school. Like, he's so quick to shut that down, when we know that the reason that Nog is in school in the first place is because Keiko convinced Rom that it was a good idea right. for his son to go. Right. So it's like, why didn't he repeat that same thing to the Negus? Because it still makes sense. It's like, yeah,
right.
he's going to the school, but he's learning about their cultures and their way of doing business and their way of life, so that he can exploit it later. Which, I was thinking about it, is totally in line with what Negus says to his son Krax at the end of the episode. He's telling him, you could have stayed at the bar and listened to all these people and their ways of life and the way they do business and absorbed it all until the right. time is right to strike out and do business. That's exactly what Rom was tricked into thinking Nog was going to get when he went to the school. So it's like,
yeah,
maybe that's why they didn't bring it up. Maybe that was like, we can't have him say that right here in the beginning of the episode and then bring that right. up later on. Like, yeah. I don't know, but I was just like, yeah, that's a quick miss for me on, but then of course it also sets up our B plot here of Nog being kicked out of school and Jake being the one to have to secretly instruct him.
Yeah.
So maybe that, you know, obviously that's another reason to leave it off.
Right. Yeah. It was a great scene to see Jake step up and help Nog. Cause you, so far you had definitely thought, oh man, Nog is not a good influence on Jake. You know, poor Jake, he doesn't have a lot of other friends to make. Sisko is talking with O'Brien, and O'Brien's like, you should have him find other friends. Mm-hmm. Sisko's like, I don't know about that. And O'Brien's like, I mean, why don't you do something? And Sisko's like, well, I mean, like, I don't want to force him to make a decision, because if he's forced to choose between me and his friend, I'm concerned he'll choose his friend.
Yeah.
And O'Brien's like, oh, I don't think that's going to happen. And Sisko gets in his face and says, well, when your daughter, who's 3, turns 14, you let me know how that goes.
Right. Let me know how that yeah. conversation goes. Right.
Yeah.
I loved all of those scenes. And I mean, that one was another one that I was kind of like, I have to admit, struck a little chord, because I was like, my daughter is 6. And I was like, yeah. oh, is she really going to change to 14? Is she going to stop being my lovely little princess? Am I going to have to put up with this loudmouth thing? You know, it's like, oh, not looking forward to that. But this episode also ties into, you know, what I want to talk about for our 90s segment, you know, which is basically the representation of black father figures on TV at the time. There were very few, and most of the shows that were out during the 90s and did feature black families, typically they were kind of their own take on nuclear families. They always had a mother and a father. Both parents worked, and there were multiple children around. The fact that you there just weren't a lot of shows that featured single black fathers. In fact, I looked and I couldn't find any. And now I could have just been missing, not looking in the right place, but I like to think that I'm pretty thorough in my research and I just couldn't find any. But if someone listening knows of a couple of other shows that featured positive black single fathers in the 90s, please let me know.
Or before.
I'll check them out. But certainly, you know, the thing about the 90s, there was a kind of like a boom of black TV shows. We had Family Matters, The Fresh Prince, Martin, Living Single, Moesha. Like, all these shows all came out around this, were running during the 90s. Some of them, most of them came out kind of like the mid to late 90s, but still, they were out. But none of them featured single black fathers. And even when those episodes, when those shows did episodes which featured parents who were single parents or anything like that, typically they featured like single mothers, not single fathers. And if the father ever came into the picture, he was most often kind of viewed as, you know, more of a reckless deadbeat type, you know, like the kid was fine, but the father had gone off. Maybe he had like gone to work somewhere and just, even though he sent money back, he like never came back, right? Things like that. Like, they tried to find a way to make it almost wholesome, but not quite, right? You know, like it wasn't that he totally abandoned the family, but more like he was working overseas, and he would show up every couple of months as a guest visit, or he was in the army. That was kind of the more popular trope I found, was that he was in the army, or he died in the army, or something like that. And then there were others where he just wasn't around. There was no explanation. It was just he was gone, and that's how they were dealing with it. So, of course, seeing the portrayal here with Jake and Ben Sisko and them trying to work through their relationship, which we can clearly tell has always been very close. Even Sisko remarks on that, the fact that, you know, there was a time when, you know, him and Jake, they were just always doing things together. And he tries to bring up those things with Jake, like, hey, let's go take this trip. You've been asking to go to the fire caves. Here's this thing that I can take you to now, so let's go. And Jake kind of shoots him down on that. And then it's, well, let's go play baseball in the holodeck. Again, something that he knows that Jake would really like to do. And once again, Jake has other plans.
Right.
And, you know, so we can see that Sisko is bothered by the distance that is seeming to generate between him and his son. But we also see that despite his concern, he does still, he keeps trying. And another thing, he never really gives up on his kid. He never stops trying to be a parent to him and to help him and to guide him.
Right.
And that was one thing that I really appreciated about it, too. Like, he didn't suddenly become, like, super angry and, like, shut down his, you know, interactions with Nog or anything like that. Like, even when he hears that Nog was kicked out of school, he even tells Jake, he's like, well, you can still see him after school.
Right.
You know, he never says, okay, well, that's great. Finally, you're done with that terrible Ferengi boy. Don't you ever go around him ever again. Like, he doesn't do that. He's just, he tries to be understanding of his kid and to give him the space that he needs, and eventually starts to recognize that his son is changing, but for the better, that he's growing up, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that like was said, a key part.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a great little scene when, Sisko is sitting there at dinner waiting for Jake to show up, and it's 30 minutes past, and Dax shows up and says, hey, what's going on? And Sisko is throwing the ball into his glove, little
angrier.
Yeah.
Angrier, just slamming it in there. Yeah,
exactly. And Dax has a great little moment. You know, she says, you know, I've been a mother 3 times and a father 2, and I never was a good parent any of those times. But here's a little bit of advice, which turns out to be kind of bad advice, which is what we would expect from someone who says they weren't a good parent. You know, go find him and, like, bring him here.
Drag him
and
back.
I drag
him back to make him have his dinner. That's what she says.
Yeah, exactly. And as soon as Sisko leaves, she helps herself to the stew they were about to have. Like, ah, great, they're out. I could die.
Yeah. I remember watching that scene, and I was just like, I'm pretty sure she just told him that so, like, she could just eat. Like, clearly she was hungry. Like, right. She didn't come for any other reason. Like, she came at dinner time. She knew round about when they would be eating. So it's just like, oh, okay, yeah, you gave advice, huh? Now you get to get to pig out on their food while he's gone.
She gets that ladle out, and takes a nice big scoop, and she has a big old smile on her face. Mm-hmm. It was a funny little moment. But then, you know, Sisko has definitely been that parent who's, like, definitely struggling, and do I need to be tough, and do I need to, like, sit him down and tell him what's what, and give him a little stern talking to? But then you can also tell he's affectionate. We've seen that before, but there's another great moment at the end of this the whole episode where he sees Jake, and he smiles, and Jake comes over, and they hug, and Sisko has some real affectionate gesture. I mean, he kisses him on the forehead. Like, that's that's real affection there. There's whatever their little difficulties might be, there's still a lot of affection that Sisko has for his son, which is great to see that even if they're having trouble communicating, there's still affection there. There's still love there. And we never get a sense that we're going to have to deal with some real tough, you know, parenting moments. Like, whatever happens in the end, they're still going to be good to go. So
right. And, you know, and like Sisko does initially, as we see, take Jadzia's advice, and he leaves. And you think that that's what he's going to do, is just storm down to where Jake is and drag him back by his ear. You know, you kind of are, you know, almost thinking that's what's going to happen here. Right. But, you know, he takes another approach, which is, you know, he investigates what's going on. And he doesn't really intrude upon his son. He doesn't come in and the big booming voice and all that other kind of stuff. He, you know, realizes what the situation is. And again, it's almost like you can see in the moment, like, it's both the relief of knowing that your kid wasn't doing something terrible, which is, I'm sure, what he was thinking, you know, the relief that comes from knowing that that's not the case, but then also to see your kid doing something that is so overwhelmingly positive,
you know,
and it's just like confirmation that you've been doing the right thing, that the message that he's been giving his son has taken root, and that he is, and he's following through, you know? And then, like you said, at the end of this, at the end of the episode, you know, we see this exchange of affection between the two of them. We know they're both all right. And again, I appreciated this scene because Sisko doesn't, what we were used to seeing in sitcoms of the time, like Full House, for example, right? They would always take a moment to, like, explain, right?
Right.
And go through this whole buildup of whatever, which I never felt was necessary. And I didn't ever feel it was, like, realistic. But here, you know, with Jake and Ben, we see, you know, he doesn't do that, but it's like he still acknowledges that his son is a good person.
Right.
So instead of having to be like, oh, hey, by the way, I totally spied on you. And, you know, we have to listen to this long diatribe about him checking up on him and everything else. He's just like, you know, you're a good kid and I'm proud of you. You know,
right.
And it's just like that. That's enough. Like, we don't need to know all of the whatever that it took to get to that decision. Or to get to those lines, he just says it. And I feel like that's way more realistic. Like, I'm not going to be like, hey, you know, I saw that you were in school at 2:15 p.m. still doing your homework, and I was right there, and you didn't notice, so you're, you know, good job. No. but as a parent, of course you would know, you know, but you don't need to go there and be like, yeah, I only supposedly like you and love you because I've spied on you, and at any given moment when I spy on you, I know you're doing the right, I can see you're doing the right thing. It's like, I know that you're doing the right thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just, again, great moments between these two. I love seeing that father-son dynamic evolve with them, you know, and, you know, even when he, you know, like Sisko tries to, just to back up a little bit, he tries to corner Jake at one point because Jake's like, he came in like really late. Like, do you remember that scene? So it's like Jake came in at like midnight or something. Right.
Yeah.
And he's like, what are you doing? You know, and that was kind of that fiery moment between the two of them.
Yes.
You know,
right.
Which, again, I totally understand. If my 14-year-old was out at midnight, I'd be like, yeah, we're putting new locks on the doors like immediately.
Right.
You're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
But again, you know, he tries to figure it out. He doesn't ever try to overrule his son or oppress his son or, you know, anything like that. He always tries to guide him, give him necessary boundaries, sure, but he never right. stops him from being his own person and discovering right. the type of person that he needs to be. And yeah. I really enjoy that portrayal more than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah, Sisko definitely realizes the difficulty of the situation is that as the commander of the station, Sisko is always on hand. He is not, he doesn't get a day off. He doesn't get vacations. If they need him, he has to go. And so poor Jake basically has kind of an absentee father in the sense that, well, dad's here. I see him, but, you know, there are times when we're not able to really get time to connect. So it's kind of sad when, you know, Sisko says, oh, I have an idea for like a 3-day vacation. And Jake's like, that sounds fun, but, you know, I have other plans. You know, I've already got things worked out. I have my friend, you know, he's his to his dad, you know, but he's my friend. You know, I need to go be with him. And you're like, man, it's sad. It's like, oh, man, Sisko, connect with your son. But then to see Jake is actually blossoming and that, again, at the end of the episode, that they're still got a close relationship is great. I do hope to see them really take a vacation together and to the fire caves or wherever they're going to go and get a chance to talk. And I mean, imagine that might be more off screen, honestly, but I imagine Sisko will definitely have that sit down talk moment with them. And yeah, I'm glad that even though this was a rough episode for them a little bit, especially for Jake, because at one point even Nog says, I don't want to be your friend anymore. By the end, everything's worked out well for them.
Well, I'm going to challenge you. I agree with much of what you said, except for one thing.
Oh?
I would never classify Sisko as an absentee father in any
way. Oh, right, right. I'm not saying absentee father in the sense that, like, literally absentee. I'm saying, yeah. like, he's almost...
I understand,
like,
because he's yeah. busy, because he's right. running the station and everything else. I get right. that. But, I mean, that would yes. be the same for any parent that's working. Like, you,
oh,
you obviously have a job
a military,
that you must maintain. Yeah, a military
sort of
job.
Any military family.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure it's difficult.
You know, but at the same time, you know, the benefit of the future being that even though mm-hmm. Sisko has a military career, you know, he's able to take his son with him to all of his postings, and two, clearly they have dinner together every night without fail. Right. Like, so we can clearly see there is an established routine here. He's there in the morning when he's going off to school. He's, you know, we do see at times when he is available in the afternoons, like to talk with his son and whatever else, regardless of how well that goes. And obviously he's there, you know, to have dinner with his son
right.
every night as well. So, I mean, I feel like as much as possible, he is definitely there. But, yeah, I mean, any time that he's not, you know, in their quarters, of course he's going to be working and things like that. And just like
right.
with any other kids, you know, they're going to have their friends and friends are around and doing different things and all that other kind of stuff. But, yeah, I just, yeah, that yeah. term, I was like, ah, no, not Sisko.
Yeah, yeah.
Worf,
right, right, yeah.
Worf would definitely fall more to me under the under the absentee father than Sisko ever
right.
would. Yeah.
I was definitely going to say that if there's a comparison to make for anyone on another Star Trek show, at least that I'm aware of, Worf is the first one to come to mind. He's
yeah.
in the same situation and does not handle it as gracefully as
not
Sisko
at all.
Does.
Not at all. If Worf has one great failing, it is that he definitely does not handle fatherhood well. And I mean, you can say whatever you want to say about why that is, you know, he was an orphan, foster parents, blah blah blah, but he just yeah totally misses for being
yeah.
so great at so many other things. Man, does he miss the mark on being a father. So yeah, somebody who needs a redeeming story on the fatherhood angle is definitely Worf.
Yep, yeah, I'm with you there.
So, since we've talked about great things about this episode, let's talk some not-so-great things.
Alrighty.
About this episode. What are some things that come to mind for you when watching this as, again, as we like to phrase it as, this could have been left out, or didn't enjoy that at all?
I don't think this is one of those episodes where I would say that comes up for me, unlike last episode, which, as we might remember, I felt there was a whole, like, second half of the show which could have been left out. But yeah, no, this was a good episode in general. You get a real good insight into Ferengi culture. One of the fun moments of this the episode, that is, that we haven't talked about, is when Quark has been named Grand Nagus, and he's preening as he walks throughout the station. He loves the new role. Come kiss my scepter. But another one of the Ferengi comes up and offers, "Oh, I'll be your guardian. I'll be your protector. I'll be your bodyguard. But you have to give me all the things I want." And it very quickly turns into a threat. Quark is like, "Oh my goodness, someone's threatening me." It's like he didn't expect it. Wait, someone's threatening my life? Which is funny because, you know, by the end of the episode, he's actually giving his brother praise for threatening his life. But yeah, that was a fun scene. You know, you have to imagine that the Ferengi culture is kind of maybe very commonly assassins and assassinations and murder and, or at the very least, on a capitalistic element, you know, business opportunities, you know, espionage and undercutting competitors, just all kinds of espionage and underhandedness going on all over the place. Yeah. And yeah, we got a good look at that this time around, and it was a fun look.
Yeah, they do represent them very well as a very diverse people. You know,
right.
Like we see them at first as always being very capitalistic, you know, but we do see that they have no problem with one breaking deals, the very deals they make, you know, breaking deals and contracts and so forth. And obviously, you know, if all else fails, they don't really seem to have an issue with killing someone that gets in their way. Right. Now, I mean, Quark seems to find a lot of that a bit more repugnant than most Ferengi, but he chastises himself for it. You know, we see that frequently. He's like, you know, I could never do these things because it requires you to be a bit more dirty, seedy, underhanded than he personally likes.
Right.
You know? And he hates sometimes that that's his shortcoming. You know, he wishes sometimes he could be as dirty and devious as some of his cousins and other Ferengi that he knows, you know, because he sees them as better businessmen, you know, and that's something that comes up in other episodes. Like, we'll frequently hear references to his cousin Gala, who owns his own moon, you know, but Gala sells weapons, and those weapons kill millions of people, you know, and Quark can't do it. Why? Because he likes people, you know, and he says, he's like, "I enjoy tending bar. I like being," you know, so it's like there's a clear distinction there.
Uh-huh.
Between a personality type. So it just shows that they are a very multifaceted culture, just like anyone else.
Right.
And we just have to find different things to appreciate about them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that this episode introduces the idea of the Ferengi rules of acquisition. I've never heard of those before until this episode. The first one being, once you have their money, you never give it back.
Never give it back. Yes.
Yeah. Which he uses against his brother. His brother finds a lost pouch of money, of coin, and he returns it to the beautiful lady. Her beauty, something about her beauty, I had to return to her. She was, something like that.
She was too beautiful, yeah.
Yeah. And then the other one was, never allow family to stand in the way of opportunity.
Rule of acquisition number 6.
Yeah, exactly. So, it was a fun episode to really start to see inside the Ferengi culture. And I look forward to finding out more about it. And you mentioned earlier we haven't seen a Ferengi woman, but it sounds like from what you said that at some point we will. I really am curious to find out what that end of their culture is like. I mean, they have said in the past, at least on The Next Generation, that they don't let their women wear clothes, so I imagine it's going to be something we're going to have to deal with by the time they show up. But the Ferengi and the Klingons are the two cultures that are just the most bizarre from our angle. Like the idea that, you know, the Klingons are this warrior culture. In The Next Generation, they say things like, it's revealed that they have like multiple organs that perform the same features. Like it's like two hearts. So like, if one fails, they have a backup kind of thing.
Multiple redundancies.
Exactly. So the idea that like the Klingons are a warrior culture, but somehow they've been able to figure out space travel is fascinating. It's, it's, you know, like, how could that warrior culture who seems primitive come to that? But when you get insights into their culture, you realize there's an honor system to everything they do. So it kind of makes sense. But then on another episode, they talk about how they don't really like scientists. So again, like, how would they then develop a culture that could, you know, be spacefaring? And so the Ferengi are another example of that curious culture. How could they have figured out how to become an interstellar species? And so we haven't seen any insights into that, and it's not like, you know, we get much insight directly into the Klingons in that sense either, but it's fun to theorize. For example, maybe with the Klingons, you know, some alien species landed on their planet, and they were smart enough to figure out how to make the technology useful for themselves. So it wasn't that they developed it themselves, but as a conquering species, they were able to make use of the technology themselves. And maybe the Ferengi are a similar species, you know, it was they were visited by interstellar species themselves, and the Ferengi, even though they didn't directly invent maybe the interstellar technology, they were able to barter and steal their way toward it, and that's how they became the international or interstellar species that they are.
Well, I always figured it was like a combination of that and just their need for attaining more things. Like, right, they eventually just consume everything on their planet to a point where there's just nothing left and they need to expand, right?
Right.
And, you know, they're that need to move outward, and then again, meeting other cultures and that recognition of, oh, now not only are there other, like, natural resources I can exploit, there are also plenty of people, you know? And even Zek kind of, he mentions that when he's talking about the expansion into the Gamma Quadrant. He says, you know, there's millions of new species that have never heard of us, and it'll be the good old days all over again. So, like, again, that need for expansion that they have, all for to satisfy that avarice, that greed, you know, right, seems to be the major driving force for them. So I think that's what, you know, led them to really becoming spacefaring. It wasn't because they had like a scientific curiosity like we would like to think that we have, but it was more, hey, there are resources out there that I can sell, and I need to get to them as soon as possible. And like I said, you know, like you said, like, some alien race probably found them, and but, you know, their dealings with them led to this exchange of information, technology, whatever, which only further propelled them deeper into space to continue to do the same thing over and over and over again. When it comes to the Klingons, go ahead.
I was gonna say, that reminds me of a scene from the film Margin Call, which came out back in, I think, like 2012 or something. It was about, it was a fictionalized version of the 2008 financial crash, but Jeremy Irons' character has a line. He says, there's only three ways to make money. You know, either be first, be smarter, or cheat. And I'd much rather be first than the other two. So yeah, that reminds me, that makes sense. The Ferengi, yeah, it makes sense to be first. They're willing to cheat if it comes down to it.
Yeah, all of that. And well, yeah, those three statements alone kind of, I feel like, those sum up the Ferengi perfectly.
Yeah.
Be first, be smarter, or cheat. That sounds exactly like them.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as you were touching on the Klingons and being a warrior race, how could they have possibly, you know, made it into space? I really feel like it's kind of a combination as well. Like, they, you know, they're a warrior race, but again, they probably were contacted by some other species.
Right.
You know, and yeah, in fact, we know that they were. Like, that's something they talk about. And even with humans, they talk about, you know, and this is overall in the general, like, Trek history, I think in Deep Space Nine they even mentioned, you know, humans' first contact with Klingons ended in a disaster, you know. And that's something that actually you can find out more about if you watch Star Trek Discovery, but we're not going to go there right now. But we know that it ended in disaster. And, you know, the Klingons even talk about, Worf talks about, you know, there's this fear of the other that Klingons have. And that stems from various first contacts that they've had with other species that have either tried to rule over them or dominate them in some way. And the Klingons have always put them down. You know, so there's this very aggressive, you know, mindset. So I think that it's kind of the same. Like, they are a warrior race, but they were contacted by aliens who then tried to dominate them. And when that didn't work, the Klingons were like, well, we can't keep letting these aliens come in and try and destroy us. So then, you know, because they attacked and won, obviously they had access to their technology, and then that allowed them to learn and study and move out into space to establish an empire that they could now protect themselves with, you know. And we know that Klingons and Romulans don't get along because they did share, they were in an alliance a long time ago, and they did share technology a long time ago, but then Romulans proved to be treacherous. And then that has, that's why these two, they don't get along anymore, and it's like they never will. They can never put down the hatred, you know, which cracks me up, because it's like, guys, that was like literally 200 years ago, and y'all are still carrying on like it happened last week. So it's it's pretty funny. Well, not funny, I guess, but yeah, but I mean, I think that's what it is for both of those species. It's just they, a combination of their own natural, either it's a desire to have more, or a desire to always be on top, be in power.
Right.
Then combined with aliens who either tried to influence them or attack them in some way that led them to being like, we need to expand.
Right.
You know?
And, yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. And so that's when, like you were saying, like, especially with the Klingons, that's why they have a kind of a caste system with things. And even though they don't really like scientists, they accept scientists because they need them in order to make the weapons and the ships and the things that will help them to continue to expand and protect their empire.
Right.
You know, so, and the same is true. Like we saw on Next Generation, there was a Ferengi scientist, you know?
Yes.
And, you know, he even says, like, even in his own society, if it's, it, he's looked down upon, but they're totally necessary. Like who's developing the ships and the shields and the whatever else they need that they can later turn around and use to either protect themselves or sell.
You know,
someone's got to do it. So,
Yeah,
we see that in all of the, in all these cultures, it seems like no matter what, prime trait they seem to be representing, there's always going to be a couple of subsets that are like, to them, viewed as necessary evils.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder what ours is. Like, I wonder from the standpoint of humanity and like Starfleet in this situation, like what is Starfleet's prime thing that we're representing? And then what is the necessary evil that we bring with it? I wonder what people would say.
Oh, I imagine... Well, if you were to ask Q or the Vulcans, they would say something to the effect of compassion is both your strength and your weakness, something like that. Like, you know, you have a lot of allies, but it also makes you vulnerable to our schemes. And Q would say that you're dumb. Something to the effect of you're not an advanced species, you're not worthy of attention, but somehow I always manage to come around and enjoy your enjoy doing stuff.
I think with Q, like I think you're right, like he would say like because I mean that's kind of the whole focus of that episode in Next Gen where he makes Riker and company play that game. You know, he's talking about the potential of the human species, like, you know, even at the end, you know, he's saying that that was the real mystery and the real adventure that humanity is on, is exploring this, you know, our innate desire to learn and grow and, you know, just kind of be out there, basically. But I think our greatest hindrance to that would be our own, you know, again, our own ignorance, our own fear. Like, fear stops us from doing a lot of things.
Right.
You know? And then it also makes us make stupid decisions because we feel like we're trying to protect ourselves, but really we're just kind of sabotaging ourselves a little
bit.
So, yeah, and I think that, you know, Vulcans probably say something similar, that we're just, we're so irrational. We do some things that seem very, you know, well thought out and well-meaning on one hand, and the next minute we do something that's completely just inane and irreverent and has no bearing on anything else whatsoever, and we seem to enjoy that just as much as we enjoyed the other highly analytical thing, too. So it's just like, these two don't seem to work, and yet y'all do it all the time. I think that would be a Vulcan's main objection to humanity.
On that question, I wonder what the Cardassians would say, because this is only our 10th episode so far, so we'll have to come back and kind of answer that question. You know, what?
For, why for did Cardassians?
Yeah, well, if the Cardassians are the enemies of the Federation, what would they say the problem with the Federation is? That'd be a curious follow-up. I don't know if you would want to try and answer that now. You know, we're kind of still early on, but...
I would think that probably they would say that we're... Our problem is we're like them, but we don't want to admit we're like them.
Oh, like, okay.
Like, you know, we...
We're actually more ruthless and...
Right.
We want to... Yeah.
Right, we're more insidious. Like, they're at least open about the fact that they have a... That they rely heavily on their military, and that they
right.
do things from a militaristic standpoint, and that
right.
you know, they don't have a problem with subjecting people to terrible things all for the sake of building their notoriety, their empire,
right.
and so forth. Whereas yeah. we try to make it seem like we want to be your friend right mm-hmm. up until the time that you reject us. Then it's like, okay, now we're gonna it's all you're the enemy. There's nothing redeeming about you anymore. We,
right.
we tried to extend that hand. You slapped it away so many times, so now we're done with you, and this is it.
Yeah. There's an episode I'm going to try and find where Picard is tortured by the Cardassians. Chain of Command, Part 2 in particular, is the episode. It's a two-part episode. Yeah, where Picard is... abducted. He's on a mission, a secret mission that fails. So the secret mission is a setup that the Cardassians, they set up the Federation and Picard in particular
to get Picard.
And part of what they're trying to do is I think you're right. I think their argument is ultimately you guys aren't any different than us. You have a high and mighty attitude, but we're willing to do what's necessary. We're not hiding that fact. That episode's great because the general who is torturing Picard says, if I remember the episode correctly, says, you know, our culture was in a desperate place, and so our military had to step up and do what was necessary to get us out of the deep slump our culture and planet was in. It sounds like there was an economic collapse and like the planet was dying kind of thing. So yeah, I think you're right. I think the Cardassians would come with that critique.
Yeah, and Picard makes that remark of, he's talking about the children, and now no children go to bed hungry or anything like that. And Picard mm-hmm. says, yeah, her belly may be full, but her soul is empty.
Yeah.
Because, they talk about, you know, there used to be culture, and there were museums, and there were artists everywhere, and then, like you said, there was some kind of cataclysm
right.
which ended all of that. And the only right. way they could survive was to become this very hardcore militaristic group.
Right.
And so yes, they came through it, they survived, but they never right. returned to that more, I guess, enlightened way of life. There was never right. a return of artisans and mm-hmm. so forth, at least not ones that were not sanctioned by the government. Like, that became their
yeah.
thing. Everything had to be approved by the government. And that's kind
yeah.
of the point that the guy who's torturing Picard makes. It's just like, you know, they now all these regulations that it keeps everybody fed. No one is fighting for eggs on the side of the street, you know,
right.
to scarf down or anything like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think
we might
that
have an authoritarian government, but it works for us. And
right.
Yeah.
And we're
yeah.
not trying to hide it. You guys are doing
right.
the same thing. You're expanding, you're making
military
deals and
conquests.
Alliances,
yeah.
right, with people and everything else. But you're doing it under the guise of everybody wants to be like us. Everybody wants to be in the Federation. Come join us. We're your friends. We whatever. But
right.
anybody who says no, after a certain amount of time, you're like, yeah, y'all are just hardcore the enemy. That's it.
Right.
You're
right.
done. So,
I have to say, I definitely would love to see the Cardassians and the Romulans. Did I say Vulcans earlier? I think I meant to say Romulans. Am I getting those two mixed up?
Yes, you are.
Oh,
maybe
I apologize.
You are, but I mean, kind
anyway,
of understandable, but okay.
Yeah, yeah. See them meet with the Cardassians because they both are enemies to the Federation, but on similar but different for different reasons. So
yeah, yeah. I always thought that would be an interesting alliance. Like, you got the Federation, right? You got Starfleet and all that right here, but then you have the Romulans, the Cardassians, and somebody else form like a third triumvirate of another mm-hmm. confederate, right? So you've got the the Federation, and then you've got the whatever alliance they want to call themselves. Yeah. And just to see these two massive powers is like, okay, we know that it's like, we know the Romulans, but we know the Romulan Empire spans multiple planets and multiple races and everything else. So, I mean, they're just as diverse as the Federation is, you know? The Federation is made up of humans and Vulcans and Dorians and Tellarites and all the rest of it, you know? So, I mean, I think it would just be interesting to see how all of that would come together and, like, you know, like, I guess terrible to think, but, you know, like how we had a world war, then we have, like, a galactic war, like, split the Alpha Quadrant in half, right? And so, like, all these races on this side are the Federation, all these races on the other side are the whatever, Alliance.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just go crazy. Like, just to see what that would be like would just be amazing. I think, you know. Well, we're coming right up here on the end once again. And before we close it out, any takeaways from the episode? Anything you want to mention before we go?
I think I've said everything I had to say about this episode. I was pleased with this one. I thought it was a good, of the ones we've watched so far, definitely on the better half of the first 10 episodes. And certainly a return to form after last episode.
I was going
to
say, especially after Move Along Home, right?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Can we pretend that one didn't happen? Just
no.
Pretend?
No, we cannot. You must. And in fact, every anniversary, you have to watch an episode. Like, that's going to be the rule.
All right, fine.
Well, all right. I think I'm pretty much good on this one, too.
Great.
Again, for me, my favorites are always going to be anything that shows that father-son dynamic is always going to win for me. So, yeah. Right. And, yeah, I mean, especially after what last week was, we definitely needed a palate cleanser, a reset, so that we can start to appreciate more Trek. So, yeah, overall, good episode coming out
That's
of that. Well, all right, guys, that's going to do it for us here at the Fire Caves. Again, you can find us on all of the various streaming platforms, Google, Amazon, Apple. I happen to listen to us on Spotify every week. Our new episodes drop every Friday, so you can always be sure to check that out. And again, you can find us also on Twitter and Facebook as The Fire Caves, a Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast. And you can ask us questions or follow along. We'd love to hear from you. So until next time, we'll see you then.
Thanks, guys.